The first case on the calendar for this morning is U.S. versus Scanlon. Mr. Fall.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Brian Fall, Federal Defender Services of Wisconsin, appearing on behalf of Eric Scanlon. Because the parties agree with the other circuits that have addressed the issue, which have determined that California Section 459 does not have all of the elements of generic burglary, notably it doesn't require an unlawful or unprivileged entry into a residence, and therefore doesn't qualify under Clause 1 of the Crime of Violence, I'll turn to the residual clause. Under that, I think the first question is, what is an ordinary California burglary? And that question is not as clear as you might think. It seems that
California is that clear.
Yeah. It seems that California uses its burglary statute, Section 459, is almost like a catch-all phrase, which will catch-all provision, much like Wisconsin's disorderly conduct or Illinois's armed violence. It's kind of to gather a lot of different crimes. It does encompass some, what we would call generic burglaries, breaking and enterings, but it also encompasses a number of other crimes, including frauds, check kiting, and things of that nature. And so if we're looking in what's ordinary, California, because it's just not an exceptional one or two instance where it uses the burglary statute to get these other crimes, ordinary California burglary encompasses these other crimes. And then the next question then becomes, is this ordinary California burglary, is it like in both risk and in degree of risk and type of risk as generic burglary? And I would submit that they do not.
The distinction between the California statute and most other states' burglary statutes has to do with this element of non-consensual entry, as I understand it?
Correct. I mean, that is on the face of the statute what it's lacking, kind of much like the state of Michigan, I also believe, lacks that element. That's what takes it outside of the generic burglary, and therefore doesn't make it qualify under the first clause.
But it does require the entry.
It does require an entry.
With the prohibited intent.
Correct.
The felonious intent to.
Yeah, the only difference is it can be invited in or not unlawful or unprivileged. And that's where I think California uses this statute to prosecute other crimes. As I noted in the reply brief, there was a case prosecuted as burglary where a child went into a parent's bedroom and stole money out of the purse. Burglary was charged where a salesman came to sell solar panels and didn't deliver on the contract.
There certainly are some odd uses for most of us who think of normal burglary. Could you address the Ninth Circuit's decision in United States versus Park from earlier this year, which seems to have rejected the position you're taking, and that leaves me thinking we would have to disagree with the Ninth Circuit on a question of California law in order to agree with you.
Yeah, I think also, and I'm not sure, and more recently is Aguia, and I don't know the remainder of the name. It's a rather lengthy decision that came out very recently, which redid their thinking about the categorical versus modified categorical approach. And I believe that was after Park, in which the end result was in this.
I'm not familiar with that case. I am familiar with Park. Could you address that?
Sure. Well, I think Aguia overruled Park because it changed the category, and then it ultimately determined that California burglary is not a crime of violence.
Can you give us? That sounds like a pretty critical case.
Yes, I can give it to you. I have it.
Would you please do that?
Mm-hmm. The case site is 655 F3rd 915, decided on August 11, 2011.
Does it explicitly address Park? And is it an in-bank case?
That, I, you know, Your Honor, I don't recall if it, what it said about Park off the top of my head. I don't, as I understand what would be, what is the holding of Park, this case, by reorganizing the framework on which these cases would be decided, has, you know, it's evaluated differently, therefore the decision now would be different. In other words,
this is another panel of the Ninth Circuit, though, right?
Yes, this was an en banc,
en
banc decision, where they decided that there, when a modified categorical versus the categorical approach is appropriate, it's a 70-some page decision that's very nuanced, and at this point, I don't think I could.
This, Mr. Fall, I got to tell you, this is the core of your argument, and this is the kind of situation for which our rules on citing supplemental authority
were
designed.
Having read the case, I thought that I still think that the reason why AGIA would not be relevant to this is because it doesn't affect this court's framework under Taylor for examining cases on the modified and categorical modified categorical approach. Using the Woods framework, you may get a different result than the Ninth Circuit does using its new approach. And unless this court is considering modifying its approach to the Taylor framework, I didn't think that it was relevant to today's discussion. I may have been mistaken in that belief, but using the Woods framework, I think the answer is different perhaps than maybe, or maybe not, that using this new Ninth Circuit framework, but I didn't think that the Ninth Circuit's framework would be controlling here, and that's why I didn't address it.
Let me ask you, if I could, Mr. Fall, about another issue. You're here seeking review under a plain error standard.
Yes, sir.
We're not talking, as I understand it, about statutory ranges. It's a pure guidelines issue. As a result, there's absolutely nothing that would prevent the district court from considering what actually happened in the charged burglary, right?
That's correct.
And the charging elements here, if I recall correctly, the charging document also included a charge of attempted murder of the occupant of the building that was burglarized, correct?
I don't recall that being the case, because there was no, my understanding of the police reports is there were no, Mr. Scanlon went into an open but gated garage and stole a opener off a motorcycle, was later arrested in his car and matched the description of the suspect from the incident. I don't recall.
I'm looking at your appendix, page 23, the count two, which I think we're talking about the November 9 incident, isn't that right?
Yeah.
We don't have the whole story here, but this is the kind of situation in which if the argument had been raised in the district court, it would have been possible for the government to explore this, for the probation officer to look into more detail in this. So I guess I'm saying, why should we treat this as plain error under these circumstances, where there's no real showing that it was inappropriate to treat this as having been a violent crime, even if we agree with your legal argument?
Right. First of all, Your Honor, it's the miscalculation of the guideline would be a procedural error under Gaul, in which case...
Well, you're not saying every guideline error is a plain error, are you?
No. That's the first part, is that, okay. One, this is a procedural error under Gaul, where in this case, by evidence by the within guideline sentence appeared to affect the court's sentencing choice. The court in this case could have gone over the guidelines too, but did not.
Because the issue was not raised, the court never had any reason to dig into this, right?
Right. I think all this was before the district court as well, I believe, and it did not. And so at this point, I don't think you can say with any certainty what the district court could or could not, would have done.
Right. And under those circumstances, why shouldn't it be incumbent upon the appellant to show that there was some something about the way this was handled, something that to suggest that there was real prejudice resulting from the failure to raise this issue?
Well, I think, again, without an explicit statement from the district court, we can just rely on what occurred, and the fact that the district court imposed a within-guideline sentence gives weight to the suggestion that it relied on these guidelines when imposing the sentence, and this guideline that it relied on was calculated improperly. And I think that should be enough under plain error to send it back.
So that sounds like any guideline error should amount to plain error, unless the district court says something that insulates the decision.
Or perhaps if the judge had imposed an above-the-guideline sentence, or some other facts that would give rise to the fact that it was not relying on the guidelines as a significant factor in imposing its sentence. Here, the district court did rely on the guidelines and imposed a within-the-guideline sentence. And I think under those facts, in combination with the procedural error under Gall, I think takes it into the area of plain error.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant United States Attorney Bridget Demoshek, and I appear on behalf of the appellee of the United States of America. The district court did not err in finding that the residential burglary statute set forth in California Penal Code Section 459 qualifies as a crime of violence. Your Honors, the parties have conceded that the California Penal Code Section 459 does not qualify as an enumerated offense or under the or otherwise clause. However, based on case law set forth in the government's brief, it's clear that this residential burglary poses a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. As the Supreme Court has explained, the main risk of burglary arises from the possibility of a face-to-face confrontation between the burglar and the third party. The appellant cites numerous cases in his reply brief in which he argues that there are violations of the residential burglary statute in which the underlying felony committed is nonviolent. However, as the Supreme Court has stated in Taylor, not every conceivable factual offense covered by a statute must necessarily present a serious potential risk of injury before the offense can be deemed a violent felony. I'd like to comment on appellant's arguments regarding the guidelines. This argument was not developed in his brief in chief nor at the district court level, and I think that under Seventh Circuit case law, this argument is waived.
Sorry, which argument?
His argument regarding the guidelines calculation. It's set forth in Section 2 of his reply brief. Your Honor, if there are no additional questions for the government, we ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Could you address this issue of Park? You cited it in your brief. Do you think it's still good law?
I don't know. Because the Aguia case that was mentioned this morning, I'm not aware of that case. There was not a 28-J letter filed, as the court has mentioned. But I do think that, as set forth in the government's brief, whether the categorical approach or the modified categorical approach is used to look at the defendant's offense of conviction, it's clear that based on the elements of the offense and based upon Supreme Court and this circuit's case law as well as California's case law, it qualifies as a crime of violence. the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that burglary is unique because the state statutes across the country vary. And so what you're really looking at is the risk posed by the face-to-face, potential face-to-face confrontation between the burglar and the innocent victim.
Right. When the homeowner invites the person into their home, it's a little hard to see how that core risk of confrontation is really there. Can you enlighten us anything? Is there anything that we available in the record that would tell us or that tells you more about what actually happened in the incident? Since, frankly, from my perspective, this is the luxurious case. That is, you don't have to worry about changing statutory maximums and minimums. The district judge can consider any relevant information regardless of what the guideline calculations show. Was this, in fact, a violent encounter or a high-risk encounter?
Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know. I took a few minutes to just briefly review the records before coming up before the panel today, and I don't know. I would say, though, that based upon a similar argument that was presented in United States versus Taylor, United States versus James, where there was an attempted burglary, the court addressed the argument that this requirement or not having a requirement in the statute of unlawful entry takes it out of the realm of crimes of violence and said, no, actually, really what's going on here is the risk of the criminal being confronted by the innocent party. And so although there are theoretically, as set forth in the appellant's reply brief, possibilities where it could occur, where this residential burglary could occur, where the underlying offense is nonviolent, that's really besides the point. The point is, what is the risk posed when the burglar is potentially confronted? And I think that that risk is going to remain the same regardless of what approach is applied here and regardless of whether that underlying conduct in the defendant's case is violent, quote-unquote violent conduct or not, whether it involved a violent confrontation or not, because it's the risk of violence posed. And the Supreme Court in both James and Taylor has repeatedly said that burglary is a unique statute because you are analyzing that risk and not what the potential for risk and not what actually happened. Unless there are any further questions, I ask that this court affirm the defendant's sentence and conviction.
It is clear from the charging document, which I take it is a bare-bones charging document, that this was a residential burglary.
That's correct.
Okay, that was really the only issue that was in dispute, at least initially in the district court, right? There was some question about that based on the record, and then objections were withdrawn when the charging document itself was
correct,
produced.
Right, yes.
So this whole issue of categorical approach, modified categorical approach, simply falls away because we know what kind of burglary this was.
That's
it was
right.
A residential burglary.
That's right. So if you're looking at the statute and you're looking at the fact of conviction, that's really enough when you're
that's
following.
Well, that's,
know.
I mean.
Right.
But as the defense points out, you can be invited in. Right.
But just because there are scenarios where you could be invited in mm-hmm. does not mean that there's no longer a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. For example, how
does that apply in the case of the guy selling, a fraudulent home repairs?
I'm glad that you asked that question because I hypothesized an answer to your response, and okay. Clearly this is just based on our hypothesizing and not on anything that actually happened.
But that's a real case,
right? But
right,
for example,
out of California,
right? But my hypothesis would be I would submit that if potentially the homeowner was aware that the person who sold him these goods was going to come and try to defraud him again, that yes, there could be a serious risk of physical injury, particularly where,
well,
for example, solar
panels.
That suggests
that securities fraud is a violent crime, right?
No, because securities fraud is not analyzed under the framework set forth in James and Taylor, which is how do you look at burglary statutes across the country when determining whether they're a crime of violence? Unless this court has any other questions, I ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Move to the second.